Hello, welcome to the High With Us podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Martinez. Today we have a special guest I just met recently in the last couple weeks, Joe Evangelisti. What part of the country are you from?
New Jersey, right outside of Philadelphia.
New Jersey. We've had a couple Northeast people come in. How long have you been in New Jersey?
My whole life. Well, minus 5 or 6 years in the military. I've been here the rest of my life.
What branch of the military are you in?
I was in the Navy Seabees, which is the construction battalion of the Navy. So no boats, no ships. Got to do construction in the Navy, which was pretty cool, actually. I had a lot of fun.
Like, what type of construction? Because I'm like, I don't
know. So really, all types of construction. Yeah, I mean, just kind of, you know, I was a builder, right? So I actually did advanced carpentry. I got to learn how to build. I was a carpenter before I went in the Navy, so I kind of had that background. But really, everything from concrete to framing construction to roofing to, you know, you name it, we were basically taught to do it all.
Wow. I did not know that. So I didn't even know they had a division of like that. That's very, very interesting. Yeah. So I appreciate your service in the military. Were you that in your early 20s?
Yeah, pretty much. Out of high school, I went to one semester of community college. I realized that it was not for me, and right in the military after that.
Did you ever use your military benefits?
For college? Yeah, absolutely. All over the place. I think I went to 6 or 7 different colleges all over the country as I was in the military. And I often joke, I think I have like 130-some credits, college credits, and never got a degree because they never matriculated as one college to the next. So I just bounced around. I got all kinds of different college credits, but never actually got a degree anywhere.
That's funny. Yeah. Did you use your real estate benefits from the military?
Yeah, like I had one VA loan once. In fact, I just paid it off my last house I sold, but haven't reused it since that last one.
Okay. Yeah, I think my brother's in the military, and he got like two degrees off of it. He's the only one in my family that's got like college degrees. I think he uses his VA loan to get his house, which is very, very underrated. So if everybody in the military, use your benefits.
Super underrated. And they've made the benefits quite a bit better since I've got now, which is smart. They've now made it, I believe, that your spouse and your children can utilize the VA benefits for college now, which didn't happen back when I was in the military. So I think it's a smart move.
Mm. Do you get those retroactive benefits? I know we're going off a tangent, but do you get those benefits since they change, or you only get the benefits of when you were enlisted?
No, I think you have 10 years to use them. I think now they've made it, and I could be totally wrong. So if anybody's a vet and they're listening to this, I could be totally off base. But I'm pretty sure now if you retire, your family can use those benefits for a much, much longer period of time. I don't know how long it is, but your family can use them for a long time now.
All right. That's cool, man. Like I said, I like this little like beginning part. It's kind of discovery because, like I said, this is stuff I don't even know about you. You know,
we
didn't even talk about this, you know.
For sure. Yeah.
Can you give people like a brief description on what you do now? Just kind of get high level. How long you been doing it? I know you've been in real estate for a long time. You kind of coach and do stuff like that, but just kind of give high level.
Yeah. Right now, primarily, I'm a commercial real estate developer. Took me quite a few years to get to this point. We did single family fix and flip for about 12 years. Did a ton of wholesale, and you know, I've done just about almost everything you can do in real estate, right? I've done single family wholesale. I've done commercial brokerage, residential brokerage. I owned a brokerage, owned a REMAX for many years. And like I said, single family flip, new construction development. And at this point now we're building Class A self-storage properties all over the country. And we do quite a bit of entitlement, land entitlement, where we'll take off-market land and you know, whatever it's zoned for, we'll find its highest and best use. We'll entitle it. We'll either take it down ourselves or we'll partner or joint venture with a developer, and you know, we'll take it to fruition.
And that's
our goal now.
Yeah. So how many total years have been in real estate? You said like single family and houses for like 12, right?
Yeah, so I got in the best time, I think the best time in the last, you know, 50 years. I got in 2007, right before the market completely collapsed on everybody, and got to learn the hard way how to figure it out.
Okay, so I'm sure it was rough when you first started. But yeah. people, I talked to a guy, and he started same time, same right about that time. He he said by 2012 he had like 400 homes. So like he like dug in and killed it during that time.
Yeah,
when everything was hitting the fan. Sure. So single family, what was the positioning pivot point to go to commercial storage and go down that route? Because a lot of people, like some people, are they do single family for their whole life and that's all they do. So like, what's the what was your epiphany to go to commercial?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have like a sexy story about it. Honestly, we just got burnt out. You know, I mean, we were doing this is about 5 years ago. My business partner and I were doing our end of year wrap up, and we tend to set our goals for the next year. You know, at the end of Q3, you know, beginning of Q4, we're like, what are we gonna do? And we were on pace to do about 100 homes that year, you know, and these are like major fix and flips, right? These aren't like turnkey, you know, lipstick, you know, $10,000, you know, paint job flips. These are like $40,000 to $60,000, $70,000 rehabs. You know, the goal was, you know, we were doing 100, and he said, you want to do 120 next year? And I asked him, and he looked at me and he's like, dude, I don't ever want to do this again. Like, I'm done. Like, we got to figure something else out. And I was like, I'm really glad that you said that, because me neither. Like this was a burnout year for me. Like I'm tired, I'm beat, you know, and there was just a lot that led up to that. Like, you know, it was, you know, and I'm sure you might've been there before, maybe you haven't, or I mean, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have been. Like, it was just a point where we always, you know, had money coming in, going right out the back door. It was just like a churn and burn, man. And my tax return said I was making money, never was able to put my hands on it. You know, like, you know, I always seemed to have money, but never seemed to have enough of it anywhere. And it was just like we were chasing our tails. And so it was just like a point in time where it was like a, you know, kind of a realization that we got to figure out a way to do something different here. Like I didn't set out to flip houses to turn it into a cash register. I wanted to build real long term, what the term now we coin, legacy wealth, right? Like I wanted to create generational wealth. I didn't just want to flip houses and make a bunch of cash. And so that's kind of the position we stuck ourselves in. And, you know, that's when we started searching for, like, there's got to be a better way to do this. And that's how we ended up in today's position.
Now, what was like, did you get a mentor? Did you kind of just buy a deal and kind of figure your way through it? Or how was that like transition process?
Yeah, you know, I've always, I shouldn't say always, but for probably the good 8 to 10 years leading up to that decision, you know, I invested in myself a ton, right? I joined masterminds, I'd hired mentors and coaches and, you know, surrounded myself with what I think were the right people. And so I had an idea that in order to scale it and get into the right rooms and do the right things, it was going to be commercial. Like I think I knew it was going to be commercial, but I didn't know what industry, what asset class, like kind of where I was going to go with it. And I think at first I thought it was going to be apartments. And I had a really good friend at the time who was kind of one of the big apartment syndicator teachers. I went to one of his events. And at the time, man, it was like, I don't know if you ever read that book, The Blue Ocean Strategy, right? Where they talk about, you know, you got the red waters where all the fish are fighting, the sharks are fighting over the fish. And then, you know, you got the blue ocean where, you know, you kind of go out and do your own thing and you figure it all out. And so I went to one of his events and they were talking about apartment LOIs, putting apartment LOIs out. And at the time they were like, oh yeah, well, don't be surprised if you find a good apartment deal and there's 150 or 200 LOIs. And they were talking about creative ways of, you know, send videos to the seller or, you know, send like gifts to the seller's, you know, office and like find ways to stick out and be unique and all this kind of stuff. And I looked at my partner, I was like, dude, if I got to like, you know, find ways to be that unique, to stand out, like, dude, this is the red ocean. Like we're fighting like 150 people to put an offer in. We got to find a different industry. Like there's got to be a different way to get involved in commercial real estate without this apartment thing. And so I started digging around even more and I ended up having a conversation with a now really good friend of mine who got into self-storage development. And, you know, it was so interesting, Daniel, because when I first had a conversation with him, he was like, dude, he told me like three things on the first conversation. And, you know, it was one of those like phone calls randomly. You think it was going to take 10 minutes. And I was on the phone with him for like 3 hours. And the first thing he told me was the storage industry is a very small community and everybody wants to help, which is so true. Like when you start talking to folks in this industry, it's not like a very cutthroat industry. Like everyone seems to kind of want to, you know, guide you in the right direction. It's not a very like, you know, so people kind of want to help. He said the second thing is, and this is a guy who had almost a very similar background. He had built a lot of communities, a lot of single families, a lot of developments, planned unit developments. He's like, dude, once you build a self-storage, you're never going to touch a house again. Like you won't flip a house. You won't build a new house. Like you're just not, you won't build your own house. He's like, you'll pay someone to build your own house. He goes, it's just too damn easy to build a self-storage. And trust me, you're not going to do it again. And he was right. Like, you know, 100,000 square foot self-storage is not that much different, that much more difficult than building one or two houses. And the upside is tremendous. And then I think the third thing that he told me that kind of, you know, put me over the edge, which was that he's like, you know, the numbers obviously much higher, but the outcome is also way, way, way higher. Right. And so if you can just figure out a way to piece the numbers together, understand the deal, wrap your mind around it, he's like, you won't conceptualize the outcome until you do one. But once you do it, you're never going to go back. And again, he was right. I did my first deal, never looked back. And now, you know, we help folks who are kind of in that single family world, that whether they wholesale or flip or do new construction or, you know, those type of things, help them transition into commercial. Because the reality of it is, it's only scary on paper until you do a few deals and you realize that, man, it's not as difficult. It might quite frankly be easier to do commercial, and the numbers are so much bigger and the outcome is so much better.
Yeah. I think the bigger opportunities create easier. They're easier, in my opinion. These small stuff is hard because there's no you have to like really monitor your numbers because the margins are so small. Like you can be upside down on a small deal pretty quick.
Absolutely, man.
So funny, man. It's like a backwards way of thinking, but it's crazy how it works.
Truth. Yep.
So you did your first deal. Now, how did you do ground up or did you buy?
And yes, so we've always done.
How did that transition, you know?
Go ahead. Finish your question. I don't want to interrupt you.
No. Like, were you buying existing? Oh, I know what my question is now. I'm going to type it out because I can remember. But let me ask this one. Were you buying existing units from mom and pop shops or are you building? Because I know now you're in like a building mode, but when you first started, were you looking for existing?
Yeah. So a lot of people think that I'm just absolutely crazy because when we started out, we went directly to 100,000 square foot class A self-storage development, right? Like we just jumped out of the gate and built 100,000 square foot, but there was a reason behind it. Right. And this isn't necessarily like, by the way, I have coaching clients who have done it the same way we have done it. So it's not impossible, right? A lot of people are like, oh my God, you're crazy. Well, yeah, I mean, maybe I'm a little crazy, but this is why, okay? Our model is that I don't want to be in the management space, okay? And I firmly believe, and by the way, I can tell you some further stories as to why I believe this, but I don't want to be in the management space because the REITs that are out there, they're so competitive. They're so good at what they do. They're so good at getting the prices they get. You know, if you Google self-storage near me, I don't care where you're at in the U.S., you're not getting a mom and pop location to pop up in the first two or three pages of Google. Like these guys are crushing your eyeballs. They're beating you at every move. You're not going to compete with them in a marketing platform, right? Aside from, you know, somebody driving by your mom and pop site on the side of the road and knowing that you're the location that's closest to their home, they're getting the traffic. You know, they're getting the clientele, and they're also extremely savvy when it comes to, you know, different types of move-in specials and rates and all that type of stuff. So I just learned early on that I don't want to compete with the REITs. In fact, if there's a way I can partner with the REITs and make them help us grow, or if I can help them, they can help us, vice versa, then why not just be a great developer? And so I've always been focused on our unique ability, and my unique ability is building excellent teams that can go out and develop these self-storage sites, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to be excellent at what I do. And what we do is we underwrite great sites. We bring the teams together. We find the money. We develop great sites. And then we hand it off to the REITs to go manage. So we're going to partner with folks like Extra Space, CubeSmart, and we're going to let them manage it. So as soon as we hit certificate of occupancy, or really about a month or two beforehand, we're giving them the keys. They're putting their moniker, their sign out front, and then we're handing it off. Now we're going to manage that asset. We're still the owners of the asset, but a lot of folks don't realize that when they see a CubeSmart sign out there, CubeSmart only owns about 50-60% all the assets in the country with the CubeSmart sign out there. 40-50% of those signs are actually folks like my partner and I that own that asset, and they're managing it for them, third party. So that's actually our business model, is to build these Class A assets and then let, you know, a third party manager go and manage them for us. That's how we started off, and that's how we're going to continue to do that. Now, that doesn't take away from somebody who wants to be a self-storage developer and go build smaller sites, but keep in mind that the big third-party managers, they're not going to manage anything that's smaller than about 75,000 square foot, which is a pretty big site. So that's kind of how we got started, and that's how our model progresses. That's where we're going with it.
All right, so I'm writing down my questions here.
Yeah.
All right. So you kind of answered my first question, but competition in the market from other funds, but it seems like you're partnering with them. And that was my question. I was kind of thinking of like, how are you competing? Cause I know just like multifamily blew up because people found it was profitable, and 150 LOIs is crazy.
Yeah.
Competing for one property is nuts. But what's the difference? I think the times have changed a little bit, and they're looking for adverse assets, so the fund and institutional side. Is it affecting you at all right now, or do you see it affecting you in the future?
Competition as far as developers, other developers?
Or just competition as far as like other storage properties in the area?
Yeah, of course, we always have to be really diligent about who's building and who's around us in the area. However, it's really about first to market, right? And so we have to be careful about saturation levels in certain markets. But if you pick the right market, a lot of people think that self-storage has been overdeveloped in a lot of markets, and it's actually not really true. There are certain markets in the US that have been overbuilt, and we wouldn't touch those markets. But the reality of it is there's a lot of markets in the US that are still undersaturated. There's still the high demand. There's still a necessity for more storage. And that's even more true in the last probably 12 to 18 months, because a lot of these developers can't get bank financing. Commercial financing is completely dried up in the last 12 months. And you're looking at markets that are continuing to grow, especially, you know, in the South and in the Sun Belt and, you know, in the Texas area and in the, you know, all along the Florida, Mississippi, Louisiana, Georgia, all those areas, where people are moving south. And so the demographics are continuing to increase, population levels and things like that. And you still don't have enough storage to contain those folks. So, you know, where you have development stopping, or, you know, developers that can't get financing and can't get these sites out of the ground, the demand's going up, right? And so there's still a lot of areas in some of those states that, you know, you could develop today if you can get the funding for it. I mean, you're going to be the first one out of the ground. You're going to be the first one open. When the world comes back to normal, which is what we're looking at right now, we want to be those developers right now today. And that's the conversations we're having with different joint venture partners and private equity firms and family offices, is let's get these sites out of the ground today, where everybody's scared to death to go do things. We want to be the people that are building, that are taking advantage of the great pricing from our contractors, because work is slow, right? The great pricing on materials, because again, prices are down a little bit. So take advantage of this market today, because in 3 years, we want to be that site that's getting ready to fully ramp up while all the rest of the sites are still trying to figure out a way to break ground.
No, it's huge. What's that timeline? Because I think you said you're trying to time the market, because right now things are a little, what's that timeline from like new development to completion? Because I know these things pop up really, really fast once you get approvals and capital.
Yeah, it takes about 12 to 14 months, depending on the type of site and obviously location, soil type, all that kind of good stuff. But as long as we're in an area that doesn't freeze, like we have a site in Ohio where the winter will obviously beat you down. But as long as you can build straight through, you're 12 to 14 months to build an entire site from start to finish. And then it takes you another 12 to 14 months to fill it up. So, you know, really you're under 3 years to fully capitalize a site like this. And again, if you start right now when there's nobody moving any dirt anywhere, you know, you're going to be in my opinion, you're in a good position turning into the next market cycle.
Now you said 36 months. Is that first 0-12 months is like entitlement, then build, then?
Well, so we have sites right now that are fully entitled, ready to break ground. You know, you definitely could take, it really depends. If you're starting from scratch and you don't have, you know, you're talking about a site that, you know, maybe needs variance or needs approval or needs, it could take anywhere from 9 to 18 months to get that done. But, you know, if you have a permit ready type of site, then it could be 3 to 6 months. It varies depending on what that site needs and what type of approvals it needs.
Like what type of acre size are you looking for based off of that model to sell to CubeSmart and that space? Like how many acres does like minimum, and do you leave space for value add as well? So you're looking for like maybe 5 to 10 acres or something like that? Or what's that baseline project look like?
Yeah, really for us. Now, again, this is going to vary for some folks, right? Because the more urban you get, the smaller site that you need and the more expensive it's going to be, right? I mean, I walked a site in Denver a year and a half ago that was on like an acre and it went up 6 stories and it was all climate control and they paid a fortune for it, right? But for us, we want to be kind of outside that suburban area, outside the major metro, generally between 4 and 6 acres. The more outside of that. So like we have sites in Houston that are 10 acres and they're just spread out and they're all single story. You know, the cheaper the land costs, the more we're going to spread the site out. We're not going to do multiple story builds. So really it depends on where you're building to understand how much land you're going to need. And obviously the cheaper we can get the land and the more value we can add to the land. What I really like to do is to have pad sites. I like to build something. If I can get 10 or 15 acres and I can do, you know, a corner property and I can have, you know, a quick serve or a gas station or a fast food location, I want to be able to do multiple uses on one piece of dirt as well, which I know we talked about when we were in Louisiana, right? Is how do we take down a piece of ground and entitle it for more than one use? That's the highest and best use for that piece of dirt. So we're trying to become more multifaceted developers instead of just thinking self-storage, which is great. It's how do we start to improve that piece of dirt and get the most use out of it, the most benefit out of it long-term. If we're going to do the deal, we want to think about how can we capitalize on that piece of dirt, not just one self-storage.
No, it's a huge, huge point. And this is one of the things where I think you're definitely in the right thought process, because I have the same thought process as well. Mm-hmm. It's like no matter what you need, get extra. Because if you can monetize that portion of what you're going to do, you can get some for free and then you have excess to kind of be creative with that property and really monetize it again with another side project, or keep it for free or hold it or leave it as a value add opportunity, whatever you want to do. You have more flexibility to kind of create whatever path you want along the lines, which I think is huge. Just by switching that model alone will probably make you a lot more money just by buying more acres than what you actually need.
I think all commercial developers should be thinking along those lines when they're doing deals. Is how do I get my basis at or below zero as quick as possible? And then it de-risks the entire deal, right? Because then you could be sitting on a piece of dirt and God forbid the market does take a dive and you don't have to pay to keep that piece of dirt or seller finance or whatever you can do to get that risk as low as humanly possible, or put money in your pocket. Now you got a free piece of land. And I think a lot of folks are not thinking about how they can control that way. I mean, rather than, you know, obviously the opposite, which would be having a bunch of risk or having a bunch of debt, you know, frankly, which could potentially drown the deal.
Yeah. What does the relationship look like with the management companies? Because are you more like the JV partner? Or are you like the lessee of the land? Do you actually doing construction? Like, what does that partnership look like with CubeSmart? Because I did not know that they only own 50% of the buildings. Like that's new.
No, so when I say they own it, so they own about 50%, 50-60% of their own assets. So like when you see a CubeSmart sign, they own about 50 or 60% of their own deals. When they manage for someone like myself, it's just a third party management agreement. So they don't own our sites; they just manage our sites, right? So it's just
you're doing the build and everything, and you're managing. I mean, is it like more like a net lease type thing management, or is it
just a management agreement? Like a property manager would manage your apartment building. So they're just coming in with a management agreement. They're getting a percentage of gross rents, and then the actual payroll and all the overhead for the employees flows right through the P&L from the building itself and goes right on the P&L and gets paid from, you know, the operating entity, whatever the LLC is that we own. But they don't have any actual ownership in the business or the company or the property. They just have a management contract.
I like that because you're really passive at that point, because you're essentially giving it to great operators that have a great reputation, and they're going to be up to date on their documentation and their processes. So you're saying, that's amazing. I never thought about it that way. That's a really good model. That's a really great model.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what's everybody's favorite question? They always go to like, oh, tell me about storage wars. How does that lockout happen? You have to auction people's shit. And I'm like, dude, I don't know, man. I couldn't answer that question. I don't even know how that works because I have nothing to do with that stuff, right? Like people's stuff gets auctioned all the time. I don't know how, like I have nothing to do with that stuff. So it's like, you know, I don't want to know that part of the business. I don't want to know how we get people. It's not that I don't want to know. I don't want to sound ignorant, right? I mean, I understand how it works and I get the reports and I have a conversation with the general manager of the, you know, regional manager of the, you know, certain properties every month. And I understand what we're doing as far as incentivization and getting the units filled. And I understand their strategy for, but again, I don't want to dictate how that works. And I certainly don't want to learn that process because they're the best at it, that they're the ones that do it every single day. And they have a process and a strategy that's great. So, you know, let me focus on being great at developing.
Now, they essentially, since they have a management agreement, this is one of the things where the property manager can make or break your business, is it could affect your NOI, which is affects your actual value of the business. Mm-hmm. They keep track with like rent rates and all that stuff to help vacancy and all that stuff. They manage all that.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, and that's been pretty crazy for the last year and a half or so because, you know, first of all, leading through from COVID up until about 12 months ago, rental rates in the storage business had that they spiked like crazy. I mean, we had, you know, 10 to 15% year over year rental increases nationwide. So if you think about that, for 3 years, we went up by an average of about 15%. So you're talking almost 50% in 3 years, right? So in this last 12 months, and I don't have the exact numbers in front of me right now, but I'm going to guess we dropped by somewhere between 15 and 20%, right? So people have kind of been losing their minds. But the reality of it is, did we really drop by 15 or 20%? We went up by 50 in the last 3 years. Like that's amazing. So... Okay. Yeah, right. So it's like, you know, people are seeing this kind of like, and they're like, oh, the bubble burst. Well, it didn't really burst. We had a little bit of a correction. And so like when I started underwriting these deals, the interesting thing was some of these markets, like for example, we underwrote deals at $18 a foot, right? Mm-hmm. We started seeing numbers of like $23, $24 a foot. And everybody was like, oh my, it's amazing. Holy cow, this is crazy. And now we're like normalizing it, $19 a foot. You know, it's like, well, we're still above our pro forma.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, we're still dealing with challenges, obviously, because interest rates rose. Underwriting has been crazy as far as getting loans on these deals. And so there's still some underlying factors that are difficult to there's a lot of headwinds, obviously, still in the industry and in commercial banking. Like I said, there's a lot of challenges we're still dealing with. But ultimately, self-storage is still a very, very good industry. I still think it's going to be a solid industry for decades to come. I mean, Americans just don't get rid of their stuff. It's just amazing to me.
I was thinking about this too, because everybody's moving from the North, and the North have basements. Because I lived in the Midwest, we got basements. Yeah. So we had a whole bunch of storage stuff when I was growing up. And when I moved South, I filled up my garage.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was just the nature of the thing. And then when I moved west to California, same thing. There's no basement. I filled up my garage, you know, so you're kind of filled up that way. So if you have, especially if you're downsizing, moving to different areas, you always have excess something and use your sentimental value with that. You don't want to necessarily get rid of.
Yeah, I'll tell you a funny story, Daniel. It's and this is ironic, has nothing to do with me being in the business. But 4 or 5 years ago, before we got into self-storage, I've never had a storage unit. I mean, I think I did one time 20 years ago when I was in the military for a couple months, but in 20 years, I haven't had a storage unit. Now, ironically, it has nothing to do with me being in storage. I realized the other day, actually 2 months ago, I got a personal self-storage. My business partner and I have two storage units, and now I have a personal self-storage. So between the two of us, we have three self-storage units just in the last year and a half. And I'm like, this is crazy. Why do I have all this storage? It's like, you know, so now all of a sudden I have three self-storage units and I don't even understand why, you know, but this is part of it. It's like, we just store stuff. Right. And it's normal. One third of Americans have or have had self-storage in the last 6 months, you know? So
wow.
It's a big number.
Yeah. My wife, when she moved from California to Indiana, she paid storage for like 3 years. because she had stuff there that when she left, and then ended up paying for it to get transported back to Indiana. And then I've been taking it with me ever since, because it was stuff that she kind of inherited after her mom died. Yep. But it was stuff she didn't want to get rid of. It just happens.
Yeah, just happens. And we pay for it. And, you know, it's just a fact of life. And I'll give you one more kind of crazy statistic, but 95% of all the self-storage in the world is in the U.S., right? This is an anomaly. It doesn't happen anywhere else, right? Like, you go, somebody was asking me today, like, would you do this in Canada? And I'm like, sure, maybe, but it's not a thing in Canada. You have to understand, like, there's a microcosm in Canada. Like, it doesn't exist, you know? It does, but it really doesn't, you know? Around here, it's everywhere, you know? So.
Well, what's the average cost to build from ground up? Because you said you underwrite your $18 square feet. What's the cost to build?
So $18. So we try to shoot for $20 plus rental rates per square foot. That's kind of like an internal goal. Cost of construction is going to vary obviously greatly depending on where you're building and what you're building, right? So a lot of people, I say some of these numbers and people are like, oh, I could build it for so much cheaper. Look, if you're going to build a cheap, crappy, you know, garage only, non-climate control, outdoor, like, so this is the thing, right? So we build what I would consider really, really nice class A, like beautiful, like glass storefront. Like if I showed you pictures of what I build, it looks like a shopping mall, but I do it because we're trying to not only have a really, really good looking end product, we're trying to be the best in most of our markets. We want to attract the clients the fastest, right? And the reality of it is, even in self-storage, believe it or not, here's another statistic, 25 to 30% of all the clients are single females. Okay. And so the market has changed dramatically in the last 10 to 15 years. Self-storage traditionally was what? It was down an industrial road, like a dark, like dirt industrial road. And actually, historically, it was industrial zone. To this day, one of our biggest challenges is getting self-storage approved in commercial zoning or retail zoning, because they don't want it there, right? Because it's an industrial zoning. But the reality of it is, it's zoned that way because that's where it was historically. That's not where people want it, right? That's not where the consumer wants it. The consumer wants it on the main road.
Yeah.
The consumer wants easy access. They want to come down a main street. They want it well lit. They want to pull right off the main road, and they want to be in their storage. Mostly because you have a lot of single women who are accessing it. And what do they want? They want to, go ahead, say it.
Safety concerns, yeah.
They want to feel safe. They want to be well lit. They want a bazillion cameras on them at all times. They want to be able to plug in their code, go get their stuff, get back in their car, and not feel like they're going to get attacked, right? That's what they want. And so that's what we build. Yeah. I build a site where there's automatic lights every 10 inches that they walk. You park your car, you get into an automatic door. There's cameras everywhere. You get on the elevator, lights are going off everywhere. There's LEDs, there's spotlights. Like, there's nowhere where there's a dark corner that they don't see coming, and they get back in their car, and the whole time they feel totally safe. Okay. So to do it properly, in my mind, you have to spend real money, and you're doing it because you don't want something that's going to take maintenance or CapEx down the road, and you got to build it properly. So all that being said, we're still under $100 a foot. We're in that like $100 to $105 a foot blended rate. Now that's blended between your garages, which are pretty much standard garages with everything I just said. They have automatic lights and cameras, non-climate controlled, single, you know, roll up garage doors, the whole thing. And that's blended with your 3 or 4 story climate control, you know, fire suppression systems, the whole nine yards, HVAC system, the whole thing. So you're going to be more expensive, obviously, on the climate control, and much, much less expensive on the garages. But when you blend the rate across the 100,000 square foot facility, you're right around that $100 a square foot. Now, you'll have some builders say, oh my God, that's crazy. You could spend $65 a foot. You absolutely could. It's not going to look anywhere nearly as nice as ours. And that's okay. There's a lot of builders out there that say, just build it as cheap as possible. At the end of the day, you're worried about NOI.
Yep.
Yeah, maybe you are, but that's not what we're looking for. So
yeah, you're looking. You're long. Are you? What's your and this is this, I love that this line of questioning is that. Yeah. So, what's the strategy? Are you holding forever, or is this like a 5-year exit stabilization type thing, or is this I guess it depends on you and your goal and your lenders.
Yeah, right? It's also not an easy question because we have a myriad of different partners, right? I have some partners that are joint ventures that, you know, the goal is to exit whenever the time is right, and then we have partners that are family offices that are like, dude, we're never selling forever, and there's buyout agreements in place that, you know, if you guys ever want to, you guys meaning like me and my partner, you guys ever want out, there's a buyout, you know, in 10 years from now, we'll give you money because we're never selling. Like, it's never going to be on the, you know, so I'm building these things as if I'm never going to sell them. Right. And then if I ever do, I might. Right. And then there's, you know, there's deals where, you know, you have to, you're looking for cash, right? So you're going to flip some of them for cash. Our goal is to build 100 self-storage facilities in 10 years. And I'm talking 100 class A, $25, $30 million facilities. So this is not a light goal, right? It's not an easy overnight goal. This is a big time goal. And so to do that, there's going to be, you know, you're going to have to sacrifice some early. You're going to have to sell some early. You're going to have to, you know, find the right partners. You're going to have to build the right relationships. You're going to have the right crews that they're not always going to, you know, last, you know, 30, 40 years, right? There's going to be some that are, you know, we sell quicker than we want to. There's going to be some that we hold on to forever, and that's great. But I always tell people I'm agnostic to the outcome, right? So like when it makes sense to sell, that's when we sell.
All right. So I have a question. This is based off the conversation we had in Louisiana. Yeah. But you mentioned you're always sourcing capital. Mm-hmm. And not all capital is good capital, which we mentioned. Right. But you said when we were in Louisiana, you said something interesting that it stuck with me. But money needs to bring more than just money to your relationship. Can you talk about that? Because I think it's such a great, it was such a great lesson, and which stuck with me even to today. And now that we're talking today, I want to share that with the world because we don't record that conversation.
Yeah, you know, I've had this theory in my mind for a very long time, and I think a lot of real estate investors specifically, and I'm sure, actually, I shouldn't even say real estate investor, but let's focus on real estate investors for a minute, right? A lot of businesses need cash, and I think they tend to lean on different private lenders or any lender, for example, short of a commercial bank, right? Because, you know, any banking institution is not going to fall into this category, but let's say anything outside of a bank, for example. I'm always looking for the strategic effect of the money, right? So a lot of people can cut a check. And I think that when you're early on, especially, I was in an event about 2 months ago, and Damon, it was a very small event. There was only like 25 or 30 people in there. And this event had Damon John was one of the speakers.
Okay.
Super good guy. I don't know if you ever met him. I've actually had the pleasure of meeting him a few times one-on-one or in small groups. And Damon said, I don't want to mess up the quote, but something to the effect of the earlier you ask for money, the more expensive it's going to be. And that's, you know, in every sense of the word, we all know that that's the case, right? The earlier you ask for it, the more expensive it's going to be. In my first deal that I ever did when I flipped the house, I was telling a story about this on one of my podcasts a couple weeks ago. My first deal, my private lender, and I'm telling you the story for a reason. I'll circle back to why, right?
Yeah.
My first lender, and I always say, if you want money, ask for advice. And if you want advice, ask for money. Okay. So I asked my first lender for money, gave me a bunch of advice. He tried to introduce me to a bunch of banks. And long story short, after about 4 months, he couldn't find me any money. And I had this smoking hot deal, and it was a short sale, and I ended up buying it. And I was like, dude, like, this is a great deal. Do you know anyone that can give me the money? And finally he caved, and he was like, okay, I'll give you the money, but it's going to be at ridiculous terms. I said, okay, what are the terms? He said, I want 15% interest and I want 20% of the profit. I said, fine, let's do the deal, right? And I forget exactly what I borrowed, but the bottom line is I flipped this house in under 90 days from start to finish. I bought it, I rehabbed it, put it back on the market, and we killed it. We knocked it out of the park. I made him so much money that we had lunch about 2 weeks after closing, and he brought a check to lunch for $5,000, and he handed me $5,000, and he was like, you paid me too much money, I feel bad. He gave me $5,000. And I was a broke kid, man. Like, I had just flipped my first house. I had like, I mean, obviously I just made some profit, but I'm still broke, right?
Yeah.
And I ripped the check up, and I gave it back to him. And I was like, dude, a deal's a deal. This is what we agreed to. And this is what we said we were going to do. And I would tell you guys this, it wasn't because I had some kind of, like, I'm some kind of honorable guy or something like that. It was just because a deal's a deal. Right. And I believe when you do a deal, that's the way you should do a deal.
Yep.
And so from that point forward, first of all, I think he lent me 150 grand or something like that. I worked my way up to $8 million at one point with him, $8 million of his money on the street. Okay. From 150 grand.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so the point is, I think at the beginning, when you're doing deals with somebody, it doesn't matter what it costs you to do your first deal, your second deal, your fifth deal for that matter. You have to prove your worth, number one. Ooh. However, I also believe this is a guy that I knew going into it had a lot of experience lending money on the single family level. Like, he owned a title company. He knew a ton of flippers. He knew where to source deals. He knew how to find deals. He knew contractors. He knew where to get materials, right? So in other words, what I'm saying to you is, he didn't just know how to write a check. Mm-hmm. He knew how to cover my ass if I got in trouble.
Yep.
He knew how to bail me out, okay? Ooh. And let me tell you, I got in trouble a lot. And when I had $8 million of his money on the street, I got in trouble a few times and he bailed me out. Mm-hmm. Right. So a partner that writes you a check is not important if they can write you a check. Are they a good strategic partner? Can they help you make connections? Can they help you become a better, whatever you do, flipper, developer, you know, can they create you to become better? But you have to get your ego out of it, right? Because if somebody's writing you a check, but you think you're so good, you don't need them. Well, then it don't matter, right? Because your ego will be in the way the whole time. You're just like, give me a check. I just need your money. I care more about today, maybe because I'm older and wiser and, you know, I've just been doing this longer. I care more about the strategic relationship than I care about the check, right? Lots of people can write you a check. And by the way, you might find, if you've just started doing this, or maybe you've been doing it for a while, there's lots of people that can write you a check and they're complete D-bags.
Mm-hmm.
So, sure, maybe you guys have borrowed money, maybe you haven't, or maybe somebody listening has borrowed money. There's a lot of people that write checks and they're a complete pain in the ass, right? They bug you. It's the opposite of a strategic partner, right? They drive you crazy. I just give them their check back. I don't want their money, right? If you're going to give me money and then drive me crazy, I don't want that money, right? I'm starting to look for more alignment, right? Money is one thing. How can we create strategic relationships and grow together? And how can I help you help me and vice versa, right? Because writing a check is just one part of the equation. But if we can't grow together, then there's really no sense in me taking your money if I can't help you and you can't help me. So I think the strategic piece of it is just as important as the money.
And that right there, I don't even want to add to that. That is amazing. I'm going to cut that whole part into a clip because I think more people need to hear that, because it's such an, and a lot of people don't understand this, like, pay whatever it costs in your first deal, your first five deals, pay whatever it costs. It doesn't matter. And I love that you've got it up to 8 million. I love you to tell the story, because I tell people this all the time. Like, I told a new partner, they're like, I know you guys got private capital. What's it going to cost to do the deal? I'm like, 50%. Yeah. Oh, it's expensive. I can't do it. All right. Deuces.
People burn bridges like that. It's so aggravating. It's like, dude, you have no, especially if they have no experience, right? It's like, you have no experience and you're trying to write the rules. It's like, dude, you got somebody who's got 10, 20 years of experience and they're trying to tell you, this is what I need. And you're shitting all over the deal before it's even gotten started. It's like, that person could help you do your next 100 deals.
Yep.
And you're shitting on them for the first deal.
Yep.
It's like, that dude, that guy, by the way, could have told me he wanted 50% of the flip and I would have given it to him.
Yeah.
It didn't matter.
It doesn't matter, because the biggest thing is, you knew he had experience and you're willing to pay him for the time, and you understood that. So you're willing to pay him through the transaction. Yes, you're still going to get paid. It's less than what you want or would like, but you're paying him for his experience. And then that opened up the door to where you're at now, 10 years later, and you had $8 million on the street at that point. But it was more, it's such a great story. I love that. When you're starting out, overpay capital, find a strategic partner that's going to bring more than that. So I love that, man. That's the best part of the whole episode, in my opinion. That was amazing. What is a quote that is yours or somebody else's that you resonate with?
Oh man, I say this all the time, but where focus goes, energy flows, right? Like, we just gotta pay attention to what we're focused on, because I mean, it's such a simple quote, but it's so impactful, because I think so many of us, especially today, you know, there's a lot of people hurting right now, you know, and I think the more that you focus on opportunity, the more you're going to see opportunity, and the more you focus on the downside, the negative, and God forbid, media and politics and the shit that's going on TV, and you're going to get more of that. And I really believe that, that if you focus on opportunity, there is so much of it out there, Daniel, you know this, there's opportunity everywhere. And the more that you focus on it, the more you're going to find it.
Woo. That's good. Where can people find you online? This has been a really great episode. I'm like taking notes, and I'm like telling my editors, you gotta get this part.
Yeah, I'm easy to find at Joe Evangelisti in Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, all the socials.
I have the Flip King. What's that?
No, that's like an old one. Yeah, take that out of there. That was like an old
one. And then you have your podcast. I want to plug the podcast.
Legacy Blueprint podcast. Really, I'm most active, I think, on Instagram, probably mostly for the stuff that's going on. Legacybuilder.coach is the coaching platform. We're getting ready to have, I don't even know if this will be out before the event. We're May 16th and 17th. We just released the dates for the Charleston event. But by the time people hear this, it might not be, we might be down there.
I don't know. I'll try and finagle it to make sure it gets out by then. Yeah. But Legacy Blueprint, go check it out. It's got 100 episodes plus, and your host. You just heard some good knowledge from him. If you like this episode, please go share, subscribe, go follow Joe on Instagram, and thanks for your time. This has been amazing.
Awesome, man. Thanks for having me.